Remember, participants, this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's PDNR call on Tuesday, the 19th of October, we have Alan Greenberg, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Ted Suzuki, Oliver Hope, Mason Cole, Ron Wickersham, Michaela Nalon. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Margie Milan, Linda Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from James Bladel, Barry Cobb, Avery Doria, Tatiana Kramtsova, Jeff Newman. And if I could also please remind everyone when to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Alan.
Thank you, Gisela. I think that was Jeff Eckhouse, not Jeff Newman, though.
Sorry, Jeff Eckhouse. My apologies.
That's okay. And I see Paul Diaz is trying to get in and presumably will join us shortly. First thing on the agenda is statement of interest, declaration of interest. Are there any changes or specific declarations for this meeting where we'll be talking about domain renewal? Hearing nothing, seeing no hands, I'm assuming there are no changes. All right. The first item on our agenda is the completing the review of the user survey. Does everyone on the call have access to the spreadsheet?
Yes.
Is there anyone who doesn't?
Unfortunately, this morning, this meeting, I don't have access. I'm just on call, but not visually there.
Okay, no, not Adobe, but do you have the spreadsheet that was sent out via email? Or you don't have that either?
No, I don't have that either.
All right, we'll try to read the whole thing to you as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
That was a joke.
But I have read it, but I don't have access to it here. So,
all right. Well, the changes are not great, and we'll try to keep you enlightened as we go along. Starting from the very first one, the tab on the left labeled RAE Q4 Q5 and so forth. I don't believe anything has changed in that one. There was an overwhelming indication from the responses that that recovery should be offered by registrars and that it should be a policy. The comments, I don't think, address anything that we need to discuss in this meeting. If I'm missing something, please just put up your hands or scream out if I'm not looking at it. Okay, the next tab is labeled RAE Q4 Q6, and this one does have some changes. A small one in that I've added a graph of the distribution of the times that the responders indicated domains should be renewable for, and I think the bar chart makes it clear that the overwhelming number is 30. There's a significant number, probably totaling the same as the one for 30 for various times greater than 30. So I guess if we add those up, it's 105. Yeah, it's about 150. They're about equal. But clearly there's not a lot of support for anything less than 30 days. Seeing no comments, going on. The next one.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Paul.
Hey, it's Paul. Thank you. Sorry I was late. Took a few minutes to get in. On this one, of course, while the poll results show the majority favor something around 30 days or perhaps more, the question, of course, did not make it clear that 30 days or more they would be getting use of the name effectively for free. You know, there is sort of a trade-off. There is truly a cost to such a long term. I mean, at a minimum, it could be a 12th of the original registration term.
Well,
I just wanted to put that into the record as we kind of figure out, you know, what the work wants to recommend.
Yeah, two comments on that. First of all, they don't necessarily have use of it because this isn't saying that they continue to have use of it. We'll be talking about that later. So they may have no access to it at all. And in fact, if I remember correctly, and Marika, perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong, the registrar survey we did at the beginning of this process said all of the registrars who responded gave at least 30 days, and many of them gave significantly more. So I don't think we're talking about a large change in the status quo if we were to implement what is being described there. So I'm a little bit confused about you saying they have the use of the name.
No, what I was trying to say is that I don't think these survey respondents, in suggesting the time frames that they would want, were automatically making the connection that you are, that a later question then says your name will go dark upon the expiration date or some short period thereafter. I think looking at this survey, trying to look at it with fresh eyes, pretending I was just answering it and not been part of this working group for all these months, I don't think it's fair to think that those respondents actually understood that their name would likely have gone dark, that the 30 days or more that they're looking for is just simply a time in which they might be able to renew, but the name would be inactive in that period.
Yeah, I guess I won't try to read their minds as to what they knew, but if they made a leap of faith and thought that they were getting a 13th of a year free, I don't think we're responsible for that. But second of all, when you do renew, the new year doesn't start at the date of renewal. It starts at the expiration date. So they're not getting anything free if they do renew. They're just deferring the payment for some number of days. Is that not correct, or am I incorrect on that?
I think you're correct. And ultimately, look, I just wanted to make sure for this working group's record that I'm on record making the point that I don't want this to be interpreted as all these survey respondents are saying they expect an extra number of days and that is basically a carte blanche to extend the registration without payment for that period. And I think that there's probably agreement within the group that, okay, yeah, fine, that's understood. You're not getting a free lunch here. But I just want to make it clear for the record, please.
Certainly, if we're dealing in a situation where the registrar does not disable the account and they choose not to renew, they're in fact getting some time free. But that's a conscious decision of the registrar to offer that. Consideration, as it were, and the registrant deciding not to renew. So I think that's a tail end case that is not going to be a common situation. But yes, it certainly could occur, and maybe some of these respondents thought that. But I guess I'm not going to worry if they're disappointed at the end because of that. But your point is taken. Going on to the, where are we? Yeah, going on to the next one, which is the tab starts ENQ10. And here we're looking for the number of reminder messages which people consider appropriate. And that one surprised me a little bit in that the current number is 2, and I was expecting the answer to center around 2, and instead it centered around 3. I think the work group answers were closer to 2. I don't remember for sure. But the numbers are reasonably clear there. And I think satisfyingly from the point of view of registrars who don't want to be perceived as spamming their customers, the number that was greater than 3 was a moderately small number. Any comments, questions? No? Okay, the tab that's labeled ENQ10Q13. And this one was trying to categorize should the policy specify the minimum number of notices and should the policy specify the minimum number of notices, and if yes, should it specify when they are sent? And it's a little bit hard to interpret these because they're mixed together for the people who said three notices are expected and two notices, and those who said two. Nevertheless, the number of respondents who said yes and yes is 251, which is a very significant part of the total population. And I've highlighted in blue, I don't know if the blue is coming through on those who are using other things other than Excel. Cheryl, are the comments in blue coming out?
I had to take myself off mute, sorry.
Okay.
Yes, they are.
They're showing.
But I'm not in Excel. So I use Open Office.
No, that's why I was asking you if the colors were showing up. Okay. So line 18, for instance, is blue in yours.
No, it isn't. I've got red and black.
Ah, okay. So none of the comments under the 251 title are in blue. Okay. That's what I was worried about. Well, what I've done is I've highlighted a selection of them. And if you take out the outriders, I didn't try to categorize all these and put them in buckets because there are just too many flavors. But if you take out the outliers, an awful lot of them who said two messages or even three tended to use the type of time frames we were talking about in the working group. That is, you know, approximately a month before and a week before. There were very few who had real outliers. That is, more than 45 or 60 days early, and there were some that, said the day before or things like that. But they tended to be clustered around the type of times that we were using. No comments. Okay, EN Q10 Q16, and this one basically asked: should the policy specify when or how the messages are sent, and another alternative was the policy should not specify how a registration agreement or something equivalent should be explicit. And the responses were pretty well evenly divided between those who said it should be in the policy and those who said it should be specified but not dictated by the policy. Going back to our discussions in the group, I think there was a general consensus, but not complete, that the business models and situations are sufficiently different and the technology evolves that we probably don't want to put in a consensus policy specific technologies, which would tend to take the 138 yes and yes and move them into the second column. That is, there should be some predictability from the point of view of the registrant, but we probably don't want to lock things in the RAA. Does that reflect what people recall as our discussions previously? Seeing no X's, no hands, I'll assume it does. All right. The next one is one that we took. I think Barry did this one. And the questions were, should the policy specify the minimum number of messages, how do you think these should be sent to be effective, essentially? There's a tally at the upper right-hand side, which shows the predominant number of people put email, a significant number put postal, and a similar number combined them. And from my experience in looking at the other ones, other responses, the combos tended to be email plus postal mail, paper mail, and perhaps plus telephone. A curious one is there were only three responses for SMS. And that one surprised me a little bit because SMS has been becoming an increasingly common way of notifying people of things. If you just look at airlines using SMS as notification, and it's a very inexpensive and very relatively reliable method of sending messages out that catch people's attention. So I was a little bit surprised that that one wasn't being suggested more heavily. Comments, questions? Nothing. The next one was who is and should it be changed to reflect what is actually going on or not. That one surprised me, and I think we had this discussion last time, in the large number of people who basically said no, which essentially said, yes, I like it to be confusing and it shouldn't be fixed. I'm not quite sure how to interpret that. If anyone has any innovative interpretation, I'd be intrigued by it. No hands, no yelling. Info Q22. This was one of the long laundry lists. There were several hundred individual responses, and I went through them and tried to categorize them. And the main categories that there tended to be were email, letter mail, telephone, fax, some version of kill the website, redirect the whole DNS entry, essentially saying some or everything doesn't work. A few mentioned notify people in who is, and I'm not quite sure how that would work. And there were 110, of which about two-thirds were just blank, and the other ones were either very vague or unclear statements. Now, if you add these up, it adds up to more than the total, and you'll see, if you look at the columns C, D, and E, you'll see if there were multiple ones, instead of just saying combo, I registered each one, and so we counted them individually. No particular surprises there. The email is the most common, and postal mail and telephone were the other main suggestions. I've highlighted in red and bold, and again, I don't know to what extent Cheryl can see this or anyone else on OpenOffice. I'll give you the line numbers of the interesting ones in case you can't see them. Line 31, and it was a common theme that came up in a number of them, send an email that contains no text speak. In other words, send something that's really clear and people can understand. Line 45 was, not sure how one implements it, but burning letters on the wall in their sleeping or living room as a way to alert people. And as a second note, it's a postal letter. I found that rather amusing. And line 200, if an email does not work, what will? Well, see above for contacting the owner's mother or wife. So we had some people with a sense of humor. Clearly, there wasn't a lot new there, but just reiterated the ones we expected to see. Info Q23 is, question was, what in your opinion should be done to educate registrants to ensure that the domains and their are renewed without incident? About half the people simply left it blank, and a significant number of others either answered I don't know or gave an answer which really didn't apply to the question. Of the answers which were substantive, some of them were interesting. There were about 50 that essentially said a message of some sort. Now, some of them said paper mail, some said email, some said a message on my domain panel, but essentially about 50 people said messages are effective ways of educating people, and I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure they understood the question given those answers. A small number, but significant, said clear information and education. There were a number of answers which said give step-by-step procedures, tell people exactly what they have to do, provide education, and that's one of the ones that the work group, of course, has been talking about, and try to make sure people understand. A similar number said that there should be information provided at or near registration time that would make it clear what the responsibilities would be. Some of those, you know, said it should be a message at registration time. Some said it should be emailed immediately following registration. There were various flavors. A few talked about requiring the registrant to tick off a box or somehow acknowledge that that they had read or understood something. There were about 20 who said money talks, and that registrants should pay more if they don't renew on time, or pay less if they do renew on time. And that, of course, is something some registrars already do. A similar number said use automatic renewal, which, of course, bypasses the problem of needing to educate people. The individual answers are some are interesting. Number 15 says is the first option, electrocution, if they fail to renew. Um, 48 takes the position that a number of people have in this work group. They're all grown up. The above should be enough. Anything else that's particularly interesting? It's like backups. They have to learn from failures. Just sell the domain after its expiration. Kick them off if they don't do it. McKaylee.
I like the one about number 50. Unintentionally expired domains are mostly a result of analog people being unaware of electronic communication and procedures. Other than reaching out to those users, there's little that can be done, which is something I've been saying for a long time.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what analog people are, but...
No, it's very simple, Alan. It's if there's a bunch of people out there who will somehow manage to register domain names via our, I mean our as in registrars in general, via our website somehow magically, and yet then proceed to ignore any and all emails from us about anything, unless, and if you say, the only way they'll react is if they get something in hard copy. I've actually had to fax people copies of what it was on the screen in front of them, even though they could see it. They could not use the print key. I do like number 15, which is the idea of electrocuting registrants. That's quite interesting.
I thought you'd like that one.
Yeah, I thought you might appreciate that. I'd like that. Oh, God, make it stop. Yeah, there's not much we can really say. I mean, there's some stuff there that's a bit odd. Other parts, I mean, it's basically reiterating in a slightly different way various things that we've said in advance, I mean, in the past. So.
I mean, most of them, unfortunately, were not particularly responsive to the question of how do you educate people. I mean, electrocution, I guess, makes sure it doesn't reoccur, but neither does the opportunity.
Alan, Cheryl here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe it's just me, but I am amused with all the funny bits, and as a stress physiologist, I can tell you how use of minor and medium level electric shock is a very good training technique. But is this a really valuable use of our time?
The humor I was adding just as comic relief. But the real point I was trying to make is very few of these answers really address the issue of education. They revisit issues of notification and trying to get proper behavior. They don't particularly address the issue of education, and it's one that we've struggled with also. So the message that comes out of this for me is they don't have any real great ideas either. Next one, the SAE 24 is what should happen, and as we expected here, the majority said kill it in one form or another. There were a significant number saying keep it running as a courtesy. Don't think there's anything particularly worth noting on this one. There were a few who took the opportunity to say there shouldn't be any advertising and registrars shouldn't be able to repurpose the domains and things like that. But I think that we've decided all those are out of scope. RGP overwhelming number said yes. Maintain the make RGP a requirement for registrars and registries. RGP Q30, which I think is a misnomer, the label is incorrect because it's talking about whether agreements should be clear and understandable and predictable, and the overwhelming number of people said the said yes, and there were very few specific comments. And that's the whole survey. I think in most cases, when you fold in the discussions we've had, it's presented some overwhelming numbers to what extent we believe we need to take those into our deliberations is obviously a question we need to look at, but it certainly presented answers that were generally not ambiguous. Any other questions before we go on to back to the comments, to responding to comments?
This is Ron.
Sure, Ron.
Yeah. Had an interesting experience a couple of weeks ago on a helping a friend with a domain issue, and this was one where they had actually paid, but the registrar failed, and then their accounts were transferred to another registrar, but they failed to get renewed by ICANN for reasons of insolvency, but they weren't really bankrupt in the American court system. But they had a .net, a .com, and a .org for their domain name, and the .org was apparently not the money for their renewal wasn't forwarded, so we got into a bit of an issue. But that brings up one other unexpected way that your domain name may not be renewed, and the because the registrant in this case did not fail to renew it, but it got failed in the system. I'll just bring that up as another example of something that could occur and did. Okay.
Yeah, I have no doubt it happens, has happened and happened. I'm not sure there's anything we can do within policy to fix that, though.
Well, we can't.
I mean, a company that's going down the tubes is not guaranteed to keep good records.
But the fact that it wasn't put back in the pool and taken by someone else because of policies, or maybe they were just lucky in this case, I don't know. But they were given the opportunity to pay again and have the renewal be effective. So
yeah, I guess that depends on the policies of the receiving registrar who took them over.
Right.
I'm sure there's always going to be edge cases like that, and I'm not sure we can cover those other than if we were to recognize that it's a very common occurrence, but I suspect not. But as I said, I don't think you can mandate that companies that are about to go under keep accurate records and pass them on to their successor. Not necessarily something we can predict.
Yeah.
Anything
else?
And, go ahead.
And in this case, it was definitely that, because one of the reasons they lost accreditation was that they didn't do the escrow, so the records were...
So they had established a practice of not following rules and not doing
right.
Not having good business practices. As I said, I'm not sure we can cover those edge cases as much as it would be nice to wave one's magic wand and do it. All right, I'd like to go on to we have a number of items that we've passed over for one reason or another in the responses to the user comments, and I'd like to go over those. Unfortunately, the major one of those we were hoping to have Barry on the call, and Barry is not on the call, so I'm not sure what we'll do when we get to that one, and Mikey is not here either. But let's try to press on and see where we go. The first one is the response to number 17, the ALAC statement. And that is somewhere around page 5, starting on 4 perhaps. Now, we realized when we were going over this at the last meeting that although we have an extensive comment in the field, it was really talking about the details of email addresses and such, and we never actually responded to the overall comment. So the question is, what do we say? The substance of the comment is giving a number of specific, 9 specific areas where the ALAC would like to see policy put in place so that there is consistent and predictable behavior and during the end of life cycle. We simply put a noted and we will consider it in our ongoing deliberations, or do we want to have anything in a more level of detail to that? In general, we have used the noted and will consider when we've had other advice which has been in the area that we've been talking about, but to date we have not had a firm consensus on which way to go. Marika, would that be considered a reasonable answer to this?
This is Marika. Yes, I think so.
Okay.
I'm happy with that.
Anything else? Anyone else?
This is Ron again.
Sure.
I have just a comment on that bothers me slightly, and so just which is the fact that when we participate in the meetings, that I thought that should have about the same weighting as if we had made a public comment. And yet, so I support having the public comments and even including them from participants in the group, but I don't think it should diminish the arguments from those who did not make public comments but made the comments during deliberations of the group itself. So it shouldn't be a double voting or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, when we get to the stage of trying to reach consensus on things, the work group rules now have some reasonably detailed specifics on how to determine if consensus was complete or partial or, significant minority views. I don't know to what extent or how one would factor in the user comments in trying to determine the level of support for a given thing. And Cheryl, you're the expert on
that. I was going to say, perhaps I can help you here.
Sure.
The work group deliberations are very particular about how the group itself is trying to reach consensus, and product that it puts out goes through a number of processes which you all know painfully well, including public comments, call for public comments, and then consensus calls and votes within the GNSO. The weighting that is given to public comment is something that the work group considers, but it is not a mechanism for double dipping. And in fact, it could be argued that if you have a individual or three individuals from a particular part, a constituency within the GNSO, or in this case, from at large or the ALAC, then the voice they bring to the ongoing and lengthy deliberations in a work group process is not going back for group consensus, in other words, being guaranteed as recommended wording from part of the organisation that they are recognising. So if I'm speaking in these processes, in these deliberations, I'm speaking as a member of this work group, I will bring an at-large and ALAC flavour, just as others will bring registry or registrar flavours to our view, and our sets of experiences will be that. But if the ALAC or at-large wants to make a public comment, that is not the same as having representation or influence in representation in the work group. And it's something that the new rules are very keen to grapple with. And in fact, some of the more recent cross-community activities have made it very, very clear whether or not you are in a work group in a policy process representing a organisation or entity or not, and if you're doing that, you're in a very particular role, such as liaison, and there you need to identify whether you are speaking on the entity's behalf or on your own. So we are making sure that it isn't a matter of double dipping. I hope that helps, Ron, because it's something that should be avoided. Influence in a work group process is a dynamic of a group of individuals. Ratification and public commentary and later vote is a matter for the entities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there is an assumption that a work group, which is essentially to a large extent is a self-forming group because anyone can participate within some sometimes set of constraints, but in general they are open at least at the beginning of their formation. And the assumption is that they will come up with results which will somehow reflect the general community and will later hopefully be approved by the GNSO, which does have a formal voting mechanism with the various stakeholder groups and constituencies represented. But there's no guarantee that that happens. And for instance, at large has a vote in this vote and input into the consensus of this group, but does not have a vote on the GNSO when the policy will finally be enacted, if a policy comes out of it. So there are certain assumptions made about this whole work group structure, and I think we're going to have to play with it for a little bit longer to see just how well it is working or not working. But it's it's not clear just how some of these things are working, and the last couple of weeks are the first time that we've actually tried to implement the consensus rules from the work group rules, and I think we're learning something about it as we go along.
Okay, very good. Yeah, especially in this case where Alan has let it be known that he composed the public response, as well as participating in the, you know, that does, Cheryl's point that it has been ratified by the
yeah, he penned it.
ALAC.
Yeah. He penned
yes,
it.
But it
for it to be a statement,
yeah.
It's voted on by 15 people,
right,
who are guided by five
yeah.
regions who are underscored by 129 ALSs.
Right.
So
and
you don't get to be making statements on behalf of the ALAC without a full ratification process.
Yes.
So I don't really care for
the and my point should be, while I support all of the points, I'm just concerned about the procedure and whether that, whether in the future, whether that should be made as a part of where we encourage participants and their and the groups they may represent to also make public comments, or because it wasn't clear to me prior to this public comment that either I as an individual or should go back to the group I represent to make a public comment.
Ron, you're raising a good issue, and in fact it came up very recently because the board in its motions after its retreat last month or this month, in fact changed something from a policy recommendation, and the change was made based on public comments. And indeed, if everyone who had been a party to the recommendation in the working group had made a public comment, you know, saying I support X and I don't support Y, the board may not have taken that action. But the board unilaterally decided on a very minute detail in policy based on the public comment, on what was said in the public comments, but not necessarily based on the deliberations that the working group went through to get its recommendation. So you may be right that history may show that, yes, everyone should go write public comments because that that becomes one of the key factors in final decisions. It would be unfortunate if that was the case because it makes sort of a sham of the whole work group process, but maybe that's the way it's going to turn out. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
It came as a rude surprise to some of us on that group. Okay, I think we went off track a little bit, and the next item was number 23. And I think, Marika, maybe you can provide a bit of background. This is from the business users paper, which was an 18-page document. And I think this was a distillation of a number of statements there that to get predictability, consensus policy is probably the way we have to go, that it can't be anything looser than that. Is that a fair statement?
This is Marika. I really would have to look back at the actual document, as it's already a while ago that I saw that, but I think so. I think they, you know, listed a number of items, and I think this was kind of the overall gist of that, that, you know, consensus policies are required to indeed have openness, transparency, predictability.
Yeah, because some of their issues are listed in number 32 later on, one by one. But I think that this one was sort of a distillation, saying anything less than consensus policy is not going to get the level of predictability that they would like to see. It's unfortunate we have no neither Mikey nor Barry on the call, but that's where we are. Okay, given that, what is our response to it? Is that another noted, and we will factor that in our deliberations? It's essentially saying the same thing. That it's a summary of the ALAC comment, which said we want consensus policy to dictate what happens. Not hearing any dissenting, I will assume that's the answer. 25. Now, 25 in the discussion we said essentially is very closely related to the ALAC one in 17. This is one from Jonathan, and I went back to that original comment because we were trying to decipher what AA meant, and Marika, I'm really not sure. There seemed to be a number of excerpts in Jonathan's comment, but I'm not quite sure where they came from. So...
This is Marika. I think AA stands for a comment that was submitted by Andrew Alleman, I presume. He submitted a comment here earlier in the as part of the comments.
I don't think there was. I don't think he did a comment on the in the actual comment period, unless he goes under a different name in the email.
Right, I need to check back then. It seems to refer back to comment submitted by AA, so I need to check what.
Yeah. Okay.
If someone had a.
I'm looking at all the comments that were earlier, and there were only three. And none of them seem to be AA. But in any case, the specific comment is reduction in inconsistency will also help reduce trouble in perception.
Sorry, the AA is Axel von Almsick.
But where did he make a comment?
I think that's probably someone that... I think it was under another name. It wasn't listed as that. It was someone who basically described the scenario, I think.
Okay.
Let me see what he was... it's the one that's called Mondavana.
Ah, okay. Fine.
That's as how it has been submitted, but it's the...
I see. Okay, in the text it has someone else's name. Got it.
Right.
Okay.
It's signed with Axel von Almsick.
Yeah.
So he's referring to that specific comment.
Okay, sorry, I had missed that part completely. I'm not sure how to respond to that. Other you know, that people presume that things are true which are not true. Other than to say, education is one of the issues that we are going to be focusing on.
Alan, I have my hand up if I may.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I agree with you. I don't. I'm not sure. There's number one. I agree that education would be helpful. Number two, I don't. I don't believe that as Jonathan writes, a reduction in consistency would perhaps be linked to a misperception about what rights are afforded by this example, by the holding of a trademark. If someone assumes that by having a trademark that exempts them from having to pay for a renewal, that's entirely different from, for example, when they get a renewal notice. I don't think the two are linked.
No, to be honest, I don't see it either.
Yeah, but when it comes to the idea that there could be an education campaign for registrars who have built up misperceptions over, I don't know, anything relating to a registration, that could be something that could be worthwhile to consider. But I don't know that there's a good reply to number 25 because the two just simply aren't linked.
Yeah, I mean there are other issues where there are misconceptions that I won't say are put deliberately there. But if you go to a web hoster that advertises free domain names, and many of them do, there's a perception that they are the person is signing up for a free domain name, and they get surprised when someone expects them to pay afterwards. In the renewal years. So I don't know how that's not just going to be education. I'm guessing that would fall somewhere under best practices or something like that, that people not mislead customers. But I'm not sure how we can fix that in anything that we can do in this working group.
Yeah, I mean, if I may, it's Mason again. I agree. I'm not sure it is fixable. I mean, that's sort of analogous to I don't know, my cable provider saying I get Showtime for I get it free, when in reality, really, I only get it free for 90 days, and then it shows up on my bill, or it's removed or whatever. So
presumably, your cable provider and many web hosters, to be forthright, have a little asterisk and a footnote.
Right.
Some,
sure.
And some don't.
and okay. Cheryl here,
yeah.
And it's that point, what set of expectations and predictabilities a registrant in this case, but a consumer in general, has on the little asterisk and the footnote. That's a set of predictable things. It's an expectation, and in the absence of it, you go, well, gee, you didn't tell me that was the case. That's something you can do in education, but... And that does lead to, you know, the advantages for the industry if it agrees on how it's going to inform people about the fine print and details. And if consumers and registrants understand where to look for those fine prints and details, that's a good thing.
Yeah, if indeed there are any fine prints and details, and as most of us know, if you've looked at some of the resellers' website hosting agreements, there's patently little details there.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree, but by the same token, in some areas, not in the domain name industry, but in some areas, certainly not globally, there may be some examples in the CC space, but not globally. In some areas, even the degree of detail and what is expected is codified by agreement or regulation. Telecommunications is, again, one of those examples where something in mobile SMS and premium service activities, the size of the fine print is defined. And if someone puts it either in a smaller font, unreadable, or whatever else, you've been a bad person and you get your wrist slapped. So, you know, there are ways of doing it, but it's sort of out of our remit, but would fit in the general better education of registrants.
Yeah, and certainly if we end up with a recommendation, you know, with using one of those horrid words of, you know, there should be clarity or clearness or predictability in the agreements people sign, that presumably ripples down through the resellers, and it's a judgment call, obviously, about what is clear and what is not, but at least the tone could be there.
Yep.
All right, did we decide on an answer? I don't remember anymore. Marika, do you have any insight as to what to write, or do we want to keep on talking about this until we do?
This is Marika. What I've noted down that education is one of the issues the working group has focused on and agrees it's as important.
I thought we said something. I just couldn't remember what. Number 26, we said we would revisit when Michaeli is with us. So if Michaeli could come out of print, out of mute, and tell us, how do we go about encouraging? Is it something within our remit to come up with a mechanism for encouraging registrants to do more active housekeeping on their domains? Or is this one of the electrocution ones as the solution?
No. It's not. I mean, the kind of problem that we've seen in our experience is, and I mean, this has been brought up by other people previously in conversations, I mean, the kind of thing where Company X, which is a, you know, reasonable-sized company, they're not, you know, one guy in it sitting in his boxer shorts in a bedroom. I mean, it's like a company with offices and employees. They end up with domain names being registered by various departments, by various members of their staff. The domains are spread all over the place. Members of staff leave the company, get hit by a bus, struck by lightning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They don't, then, you know, the domains expire, and then it's, oh, my God, it's the end of the world.
Sure.
I mean, what I was referring to, and I can't remember the exact comment I posted, but the general gist of it would be, you know, that it's everything like this is a two-way street. Personally, I've always said that post-expiry isn't the issue, it's pre-expiry. So there is no way on this earth for a registrar to know that you have changed your email address unless you inform the registrar that you have changed your email address. And postal mail won't work if you have moved offices or something like that, so that won't work either. SMSs won't work if you change your mobile phone number. And the reality is that you end up with certain registrants feel that, you know, the registrar should be all-seeing and all-knowing, which is simply reasonable.
Any service provider should. people feeling that doesn't make it practical, however. But my question, I guess, was focused around, you said problems could be avoided if time and energy were focused on encouraging registrants to
know,
well, it's the kind
be more careful. But I'm not sure whose time and energy we're talking about.
Okay, all right. Well, to answer that, I have no idea what you have in Canada or in other countries. But I mean, in Ireland, for example, we have the Irish Internet Association. We have small firms associations and various other groups like that that are in contact with businesses of all shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm.
For registrars to be trying to do this, we can only do so much. Plus, as well, we're seen to have vested interests. So it kind of goes back to this thing that Cheryl mentioned many moons ago about some kind of, I think it was an AUDA-based website, which was giving people some kind of education on domains. I think she knows what I'm talking about. So I hope she
does. Yes, I do.
I mean, this kind of thing somewhere, I would be much happier seeing ICANN spend a couple of $100,000 of its budget on something like this rather than getting a second office in California.
They didn't ask us our opinion, did they?
Considering they're spending...
Okay, so what you're talking about, it goes back to the education issue and presumably done at an ICANN level, and then registrars support it by pointing to it at the appropriate times and things like that.
If I can just give an example.
I wouldn't say it's just ICANN and just registrars. I mean, it's also a case of, you know, ALAC and its ALSAs or whatever national entities there are. I mean, I see a lot of, you know, registrars need to do this, registrars need to do that. It would be good to get, you know, these pointing people at things that they need to do that instead of focusing on, you know, the negative side of things.
Okay, so essentially this comes under the description, the general section of education that we said at some point we need to focus on what are we going to recommend to anyone, be it ICANN or subsets of ICANN or industry associations, to do to try to make sure that registrants don't hurt themselves.
Yeah, I mean,
if indeed we form a consumers constituency or stakeholder group or whatever, not a consumers, consumers. That's clearly the kind of thing that could come under their bailiwick also.
Well, I don't see why that's the consumers. I mean, I thought that was what ALAC was meant to be doing.
Perhaps the at large, the RALOs and the ALSs are meant to be doing that. ALAC's job is an advisory committee to the board that facilitates those activities.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly some ALSs that may consider this within their domain. Other ALSs have not, you know, are involved in internet-related things, but are not specifically looking at consumer issues and that kind of thing. But if there were a consumer constituency within the NCSG, and there's been talk of that for the last several years, then certainly consumer education is one of the things that their members, you know, have in their list of challenges and responsibilities. So I think this one comes back to our education one, and it's an item that we know we need to address before we wrap up.
I mean, okay. Basically, from my perspective, I mean, as a registrar, we can blog about it, we can tweet about it, we can put it on Facebook, we can say it to people, we can remind them, and all the other registrars can do the same thing. But the point being that, you know, other organizations might be in a better position to communicate those kinds of things to, you know, the mass on wash, whatever. I mean, you know.
Under the general tone of education, we're not in a position to necessarily advise or direct groups outside of ICANN what to do, but we can certainly come up with suggestions, the things that we can try to encourage other people to do.
If I may, I've put in the chat the link that Michaela was referring to, but I've also mentioned that, you know, as a resource, you know, we have that on CD and on some drives and whatnot sorts of things. And it's those resources that we put out, in Australia at least, to the influencers and people who are in a position to directly influence and assist and educate registrants. So the offices that assist businesses doing business name registration. We, you know, send it off to, you know, the practicing accountants and lawyer type groups, you know, various of the times when we give talks in any of the professional organisations. Yeah, we give them a pile of these for them to then distribute to the end user, because they're at the interface where that works. They're the ones who are sitting down saying, you need to have a, you know, a .com.au for this, and, oh, as you're doing, you know, here's some background information for you. And that's something I can, certainly could do under the guidance of the requirements by industry and the desires of consumers.
I'm happy with that. Marika, do you feel comfortable knowing to draft something so we can take a look at it?
Marika, does someone have a good summary?
Education ICANN and tools for use in outreach of same.
Yep. And, well, and prefixed by to that, the work group will consider the following.
Thanks.
Okay. Next item, the next and last item is number 32. At the last meeting, we went back and forth about whether to address these one by one or in a group, and I think we decided that they were different enough from each other that we had to do them one by one. Some are going to be a lot easier than others, and some might really require Barry, who wrote the CBUC document, to be present on the call to go into it in more detail, but some of them I think we're in a position to come up with responses to pretty quickly, and I'd like to continue going that. We have another 20 minutes or so. And I have another commitment. I'd like to make sure we don't run over today. If we end a few minutes early, that would be fine. But I suggest we at least start, and we may finish this quickly. Okay, the first one is adequate documentation and expiration process, current and proposed models. If I can summarize the discussion last time, and I just listened to it this morning, so I'm moderately up on it. I think there was general feeling that we had no intention of trying to document the current process on the assumption that the proposed process was going to be simpler. It was something that we said would be required, but not necessarily done by this group. There is a previous question or comment by Jocelyn, I think, that said essentially the same thing. And I think we can use the same answer on that one. Seeing no hands or hearing screams. The next one was one that I thought we were going to have unanimity on, but in a very brief discussion last time, we did not. And the recommendation says change confusingly similar terms like automatic renewal versus auto-renew grace period so that they're not confusing. And I personally thought that was essentially a no-brainer, because currently many registrar agreements or registration agreements use the terms automatic renewal, and that's an expression describing the registrant-registrar relationship. That is, the registrar will charge your credit card and renew it for a period of time. And they also mention the auto-renew grace period because they're talking about the 45-day period or something like that. And the statement has been made that those two terms in the same agreement to someone who doesn't spend their life doing this is rather confusing. So I would be delighted to see a recommendation coming out of this group that we change that terminology to be sufficiently different that it's not confused.
there was at least one comment last time, and it's from Jeff, and he's not on the call, so I don't know if anyone else wants to speak to it or we want to defer this one, that they're both industry standard terms and we don't want to change either of them. Any thoughts on the call?
Yeah, this is Ron.
Yep, and Michaela after you.
Okay. Yeah, I was surprised that it would be difficult to get consensus on this issue because on the face of it, they do appear so similar, but yet I can see that they are standard terms. So I'm of the mind that it, as difficult as it is, finding a better term for one or even for both, if we want to be neutral, have to change both terms, might, then we would have something concrete to discuss rather than just it should be better. And,
okay.
And I'm saying this without offering a suggestion, but...
Yeah. Well, I do have a suggestion, but we'll go on to the other people first. But I will point out that in the registrar survey we did at the beginning of the process, there were several registrars who confused the two terms. So let's go on. Michaela?
Well, first thing, just as a kind of, you know, I love to throw these little spanners at you from time to time, Alan. They're probably not confusingly similar if your mother tongue isn't English. And don't forget that there are plenty of registrars and registrants who are dealing with this stuff on a day-to-day basis through languages other than English. So I felt that needed to be said. With respect to the first thing, out of the documentation exploration process, current proposed models, isn't there already a kind of a chart site thing that was done out some time ago by Rob Hall or somebody?
It documented the procedure that was in place before there were a lot of other changes, you know, such as registrars being able to transfer auction sell domains during the expiration process. It has been modified to try to reflect that, and as a result has become an exceedingly confusing chart. But yes, there was a chart. There was and is a chart, and I think it's in our report.
Okay. Are consistent performance domain status flags across registries, registrars, and TLDs?
Yeah, I'd like to say one bullet at a time at this point.
Okay.
Mason?
I'm not an attorney, so I don't know the answer to this. But do we know to what extent, if any, those names are built into any contracts or agreements, either the RAA or registrar terms and conditions?
Well, the auto renew grace period is definitely a term used in the registry agreement, I believe. Whether it's in the RAA, I'm not sure. So that is a defined term within ICANN.
Right. I bring it up, and again, just like Ron, I don't have a solution to this problem. But I'm bringing up what may be a difficulty, which is if those are baked in somehow as legal terms, then changing them requires the cooperation of lawyers, which we all know is difficult at best. And then. I don't know if it may be more trouble than it may create more problems than it solves, frankly, if we seek to do that. I don't argue with you know, the hoped for outcome that we eliminate confusion. I'm just pointing out that it may not be as easy as it looks. So we should take that into consideration.
Well, I can't do anything but agree with that. And a recommendation that we do something may end up being completely impractical.
Yeah.
On the other hand, ICANN is continually reinventing new terms, and we do this on a regular basis. I don't think there's any word within ICANN which is not used in at least two different ways.
Right.
And you have to intuitively know. And in this case, to take automatic renewal and tell someone it's not the same as auto-renew, which is the first part of each of the words, is not going to yield anything but a confused person.
No, I agree with you on
so,
that. My point is that, you know, if you've got several hundred registrars, which you do, and they all have slightly different terms and conditions governing their relationship with the registrants, you're going to have at least one attorney, if not several hundred more, say, no, that's a term of art on which the company and the registrant rely as a way to define their relationship, and I'm not going to change it. Only because it's been in place for, you know, if I've had that customer for 10 years, you know, I, as your attorney, am not going to start changing definitions on you because it creates too much confusion, perversely, you know, the opposite of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about relatively unknowledgeable consumers getting involved in this, and the term automatic renewal is something which is used on magazine subscriptions and your cable TV and who knows what else, and,
right,
you know, insurance. I don't think we want to try to change that concept in general parlance. On the other hand, auto-renew grace period is not something that flows off people's lips on a normal case, normal situation outside of ICANN, and maybe
right,
there's an opportunity to fix it, although, as you say, it may be just too impractical to do it, certainly in the short term.
Yep. Okay.
But to say, as a principle, we want to try to avoid having two different terms used in the same agreement which have completely different meanings, I think that's an awful good principle.
Yeah, to the extent it's achievable, I agree. Yeah.
Too bad our forefathers didn't recognize that when they were right doing this the first time. Michele.
I mean, just moving on. Can we just say that we agree, we note their comments, we agree with the spirit of it, but there may be issues with respect to implementing it.
We agree with the principle, and we will look at to what extent it is practical or possible.
Well, I don't think it's within our remit to do that, though. Because, I mean, as Mason has pointed out, a lot of these things are going to be in lots of different contracts.
Indeed, but I don't think we should rule out making the recommendation because it's going to be difficult or difficult to achieve. It may not happen, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't state it as an intent in principle.
No, that's fine. But
again,
is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, nothing we say is. Everything we say is subject to implementation, as we found out in a number of other PDPs over the last year, including the GTLD one. Implementation counts. Anything else on this one? All right. Point number three, provide consistent and informative domain status flags across registries, registrars, and TLDs. To what extent are we are suggesting something like akin to this with regard to the whois status of renewed or not renewed. The registries made a recommendation that saying, while we fix up that, maybe we should fix up the rest of them. And our response to that was that may be something that needs to be done, but it's not in our scope. And I think this one falls under that same answer. To the extent that we're recommending changes in status flags, if we do, making them consistent and informative will be a good thing. Outside of that, I think it's outside of our scope. No dissent? Let's go on. Provide consistent service disruption across registrars on expiration. That comes down to does the DNS stop working? Does it get redirected? Whatever, and I think this is one of the items that we will be focusing on and making potentially making a recommendation on. Mason.
Okay. So again, I'm not a lawyer. has thought been given to the idea of liability for a registrar should legal action be taken against the registrar in the event of service disruption, even if it's disclosed prior in the terms and conditions?
Pretty much every registrar in the world that I know of currently disrupts web service, if not the other services, near round expiration. Have you been sued? I don't know.
Well,
I don't monitor those things. I presume you
yeah.
do.
Well, you're in business long enough, you're going to get sued, whether it's one
well,
or
of course,
not.
Yeah. Suit is not the issue. The question is, do they have a valid case against you?
Which you know requires you to get retain an attorney and incur costs
sure.
anyway.
I would have thought when it's post expiration that if your contracts are worded as carefully as registrars tell me their contracts are worded, that probably shouldn't be an issue, but I don't know.
Okay, all right, I'm going to let that go for now then.
I mean, ultimately, you're going to kill the service sometime if no one pays. We have Paul.
Thanks, Alan. I just wanted to note here that I think we're going to have to be careful. Consistent kind of goes against the competitive nature of the registrar market, differentiation that exists. In some of the discussions we've had with other registrars talking about the work of this particular working group, the idea that some are like, hey, don't tell me, they're not against certain things, they just don't want to be told exactly when certain actions need to be taken. I'm just very concerned that if in trying to find a, quote, consistent term, that we're going to start getting into prescribing how businesses should be run, and while we're all, I think most registrars are for good communication, clearly defined terms, et cetera, but the group just needs to be very careful as we move forward about telling registrars when they should take certain actions, if that's what was meant by consistent in this particular bullet point.
Well, I mean, I think ICANN is legally within its rights. The original RAA said, should ICANN come up with any policies regarding how domains are handled at expiration, registrars will follow them. Now, that doesn't mean we should make stupid recommendations, and ICANN should enact stupid policies or ones that are exceedingly disruptive to large numbers of registrars and registrants. So I think we have an obligation to think about these things before glibly making a recommendation. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't think about it and perhaps come up with a recommendation to do that policy be enacted to require some specific thing. I mean, right now a registrar cannot sell a domain name for 12 years because 10 years is the limit. And yes, it may disrupt someone's business model, of selling a domain name for life, but that's one of the limitations. So I think we have a responsibility to do things with care and understanding the issues, but that doesn't preclude that we actually do make some specific targeted recommendations. Does that mesh?
I think we're agreeing on the same part, that let's take care when we get to the point of defining what those steps would be.
And as you know, I'll take off my chair hat and put on my ALAC hat, and if you look at the ALAC comment, we specifically said, but there should be exceptions to handle business models and various other things. Now, that doesn't mean this group is going to say that, but even the ALAC, in its ferocity to get policy enacted, says there may be exceptions and there may be special cases. Marika, do you feel comfortable about this one, or do you want actual words?
Well, if someone has some good words, I always prefer that.
Okay, we're sort of hoping you come up with the good words. Let's see. Are we Are we still on the service disruption one right now, or are we on the next one? I've lost track. I think we're on the service disruption one. I think the answer is this is one of the key points that the work group is looking at, and we will be considering during our deliberations how to address it. Next one, provide consistent notification, display of deletion, automatic renewal, auto-renew grace period, redemption grace period policies on registrar reseller web pages. I'd like to defer that one until Barry's on the call, because I don't want to be debating what he means by consistent, and I think the subtleties count in this particular one. So if there's no objection, I'd like to defer that one until Barry can participate. Let me make a notation of that one. Provide consistent redemption grace period intervals rather than leaving it up to provider discretion. I don't think there are inconsistent redemption grace period intervals. I'm going to defer that one to Barry unless someone else can give some light on that short of asking him. My understanding is the RGP is one of the few things that is consistent to the extent that it's offered and available. No comments? Okay. Provide consistent post-expiration implications when registrants elect not to automatically renew domains and opt out of monetization of web addresses. The first part, I believe, it's the same answer, is this is one of the key issues that we're looking at, and we will consider it. The opt-out of monetization, I think we have decided when we talked about it before that is out of scope, in that the monetization does not directly control whether someone can renew it or not, and therefore is not within what we're discussing. And I think we already answered that somewhere else, although I'm not sure. Mason?
No, that was, you just answered my question. At first I was going to look for clarification because I wasn't sure what that meant, but I agree with you that it's out of scope.
And McKaylee?
Pretty much out of scope. I mean, if the domain hasn't been renewed, then what the registrar does with the domain isn't really a concern.
Well, it may well be, and there are some people who interpret even the current RAA as not truly allowing that, but that's rather moot. It's not an issue on this PDP.
Yeah.
If it doesn't directly impact the ability of the registrant to renew, it may be a horrible sin and against every rule, but it's not our sin to correct. And whether it is or not is certainly something subject to discussion and not a discussion that I think we want to be holding. Anything else? Next one. We're down to the last two. Shift all TLDs to thick registry model to aid in normalizing WHOIS-based processes. I think as a recommendation in its own right, that is completely out of scope for us. It may well be that if we make a recommendation on changing WHOIS to reflect the current renewal status, the people looking at implementation might decide that the only possible way to do this is with a thick registry, and that could be a fallout of it. But since I don't really imagine that's likely to happen and it's outside of our scope to explicitly recommend, I don't think we can do anything about that. Does anyone feel differently on that? It's interesting, of course, that with the new TLDs, they will all be thick registries, and there may well be pressure in the long term to convert all registries to thick. But again, that's not within the scope of this PDP. Comments? None. Evaluate any conflict of interest registrar either generates revenue from renewal or monetization aftermarket drop catching.
Paul?
Thanks, Alan. If Barry posted these, I'd just like to go back to and ask why. Why is this an or statement, an either or? I mean, all the others made sense in the context of this working group, but this one seems like they're just trying to dictate a business model. And I'd like to just follow up with them. Why? What is their justification or rationale for it?
Well, I know I can say what has been raised before. I wasn't the one who raised them, but I could try to answer on his behalf, but we could simply wait for him. I mean, the issue that's been raised a number of times is that there is hypothetically more money to be made in the domain not being renewed and therefore sold for in the aftermarket than simply getting the couple of dollars you get per year out of renewing it. And that's the substance of the potential conflict. I'm not sure we're in a position to evaluate it, however. Nathan? Anything else? Yeah.
I'm sorry, Paul, were you finished?
You may make the point, Mason, because you've made it in the past about the tremendous acquisition costs that registrars incur to get those customers. I think it's extremely facile to say that registrars are more interested in grabbing the quick bucks and auctioning off somebody's expired name than in doing everything they can to retain that very expensive customer.
I don't think anyone's claiming that all registrars are in that position. There has been the claim made that some registrars may be in that position.
But this proposal from the CBUC would apply across the board, and that's what I don't understand. They're dictating models. They're not trying to create a fair policy here.
Let's continue with the speaker list, Mason.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see like seven or eight arms of issues shooting off of this one bullet point.
Ooh, it's a good last point. And
yeah,
we are past the hour and a half, by the way, so I don't want this to go on too long. We can resume it later, but let's go through the speaker list. Mason?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do agree with Paul. I mean, at the root, I mean, this seems like quite an overreach for this group. I mean, if the purpose of the group is to prevent unwanted or unintended expirations of names, then dictating business models post expiry is not appropriate. I mean, my company provides an aftermarket service for more than 200 registrars, and I think that there is an assumption being made without any facts being provided about why this would need to be addressed in the first place. And in our experience, fewer than one time per month is a name submitted for auction when the registrant calls in a panic and asks for it to be taken out, which we promptly do, I might add, if that does happen. I find it to be candidly an arrogant assumption about registrars' business models that a conflict does exist, that we would prefer to throw a customer over the side for an auction rather than maintain a productive customer relationship. When you look at where revenue is generated from customer relationships, it is not through domain name related transactions. It is primarily through other services provided that customer after a domain name is used as the acquisition point for that customer. So I'm very, very troubled by this, and I find it to be completely inappropriate.
Okay. I guess I'd like to defer the any more substantive discussion. I'll let Nikhaili get a chance at the mic, but defer it till when someone is here from CBUC to discuss it, because I don't feel it's fair or appropriate to do it otherwise. But, Nikhaili, I'll give you a moment, but we'll resume this sometime in the future.
Right, well, I'll echo what Paul and Mason were saying. The other thing as well is that if we manage to make changes, proposals, whatever, so to deal with whatever outlying cases may possibly exist where registrars don't inform their registrants, et cetera, then I see this entire thing as being completely moot. If the registrars are giving the registrants notification and warning of pending domain expiry, and the registrant chooses to ignore that, what happens to the domains afterwards is, you know, it's irrelevant. And I'd echo all that was said previously.
I could add something, but again, I'm taking the role of Barry, and I don't and the business users, and I don't feel comfortable doing that. So I'd like to defer the completion of this discussion until a future time. Next meeting next week, everyone ready, or do we want to are schedules such that we prefer to do 2 weeks at this point?
Mason here, I prefer 2 weeks. I'll be traveling.
Marika?
Yes. 2 weeks.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to point out that the document deadline for Cartagena is coming up. That's the 15th of November, so the group might want to think about whether there's something they would like to put out for community discussion or review in time for the meeting.
I think we'd like to put out finish putting out the responses for this and the results of the survey in some public forum. I'm not sure whether it takes the port of the form of an amended report or some other document, but I don't think we're in a position to have any firm proposals to discuss at Cartagena. The timing is just not going to allow that. So I would like to get the results of the work we've done since Brussels out there, and I think we should have adequate time to meet that deadline. A meeting 2 weeks from now puts it, where are we right now? That would put it at the at the 2nd of November, which is just 2 weeks before. I feel comfortable waiting the 2 weeks, and I think that will give us enough time to close out whatever document, to decide next week on the next meeting on exactly what form, and perhaps we can have a discussion on email looking at the investigating what our options are in terms of putting something out. I don't see putting it out for formal comment at this point, but I think making it available to the community does have some merit. Do people feel comfortable with that?
Yep.
We'll be able to
then two weeks it is, and we'll do on email trying to investigate what our options are for putting something out to try to get any feedback or at least reaction from the community. And I think we need to Marika, what's the deadline for scheduling meeting rooms?
This is Marika. We've actually we haven't even received the forms yet to start booking meetings, but what I can do is just plan in a meeting. If there's any preference for a day time, I can put in that request so we have a space and we can then decide closer to the date what we exactly want to do. What will be foreseen is an update to the council, and I think that's tentatively penciled in for Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, no, that one I assume is a given. But at this point, it's not clear whether we want a public meeting or there'll be enough work group people to actually do some substantive work. If we're actually at the stage, which I'd like to be by December, on trying to decide how we wrap up this working group, then a face-to-face meeting may well have some merit if there's going to be enough people in attendance.
Like, this is Marika. I can ask. I can work with Gisela. Maybe we can, send out a request to everyone to indicate whether they're attending or not. And what I can already do in the meantime as well is to start reworking the initial report to, changing some.
That would be useful, because if indeed a significant number of people are there, we want to try to find a time where they can actually attend the meeting and minimize conflicts. So if you could start working on that with Gisela, I would appreciate that. Okay, I thank you all for, I think, a very productive meeting, and we're at least making some progress. Thank you all.
Bye.
Thanks, Alan.